Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Wednesday, February 18th, I'll be reading to you from the Daily News of Newburyport. Whittier Replacement Project Returns by Jonah Frangiosa, staff writer, Haverhill. Last week, folks from Whittier Vocational Regional Technical School spoke before the Haverhill School Committee, providing a program and facilities update, sharing developments with the new lottery admissions system, and the long-discussed building project. Associate Superintendent and Principal Chris Laganas, Whittier Tech School Committee member Dick Early, and Committee Chairman Scott Wood addressed Haverhill school officials on Thursday. The meeting was the latest step after a $445 million building proposal failed to harness enough support in 2024, and school officials have said the building conditions continue to deteriorate. The focus of the update was the Whittier Tech Building Project, which has formed a municipal working group made up of town managers, town administrators, and the mayors from the district's 11 member communities. The member group, which includes 9 Haverhill residents of about 20 members, has met previously 15 times to push the building replacement further along. A school building committee, as well as a regional agreement amendment committee, have both been formed for the same purpose. Whittier officials have mandated that the aging building, originally constructed in 1973, requires significant infrastructure upgrades and core improvements. In August, Whittier Tech was invited by the Massachusetts School Building Authority, MSBA, to enter an eligibility phase for their plans. MSBA must be involved in any school district attempting to secure state funding for a building replacement or renovation. Whittier Tech is aiming to enter the feasibility study process soon, said Laganas, examining several options. Relocating to the Northern Essex Community College, NECC, Haverhill campus, 100 Elliott Street. Constructing a new building at the existing site, 115 Amesbury Line Road. Renovating the facility or renovating with an addition at the facility. Laganas shared deadlines and timeframes, like the 270-day eligibility period. Whittier Tech received its invitation into eligibility from the MSBA on December 13, 2024. And the target date for an invitation to the feasibility study phase is April 28th. Districts that complete preliminary requirements to MSBA's satisfaction may receive an invite from the Board of Directors to move into feasibility. That phase can take up to 931 days, or roughly 2.5 years, to complete feasibility and schematic design. Actual feasibility work can take anywhere from 9 to 18 months. Whittier Tech will partially fund the $2.5 million feasibility study, no cost to the cities and towns, Laganas said. He also referenced a wastewater treatment plant study with an anticipated repair cost of $550,000. Laganas added that for the 2025-2026 school year, Whittier Tech secured more than $2 million in entitlement and competitive grants. The principal updated the committee on the school's career technical programs, offering 21 technical areas currently, including advanced manufacturing, carpentry, engineering technology, and welding. Construction Craft Laborers, CCL, closed at the end of the 2024-25 school year, Early Education and Care EEC will close at the end of this school year, and Design and Visual Communications DVC will close at the end of the next school year. These cuts were confirmed at a Whittier Tech School Committee meeting in February of last year, where School Superintendent Maureen Lynch originally proposed eliminating five of their 24 programs at the time. CCL merged with Masonry, while committee members voted to EEC and DVC due to declining enrollment and lack of students showing enthusiasm in the areas. Laganis also shared that NECC received early college designation from the state in 2021, which recognizes a partnership between a local high school and a college and allows students to take college-level courses for credit during the school day. "We're running strong," Laganis said. "We have over 200-something kids that are in the program." He segued to enrollment data before addressing the school's recent adopted lottery system, showing that the committee that 865 of Whittier Tech's 1,282 students are Haverhill residents, 67% of the student body. As for Haverhill admissions, the school received 437 complete applications, with 285 accepted, 152 waitlisted, and 227 enrolled. The MSBA adopted new regulations last year, requiring vocational technical schools with waiting lists to use a lottery-based admissions process. The state implemented the mandatory lottery system for career and technical education schools with more applicants than available seats. The Whittier Tech School Committee voted to use an unweighted lottery system, so every student with a completed on-time application has an equal chance of selection. Seats will be apportioned based on each community's 10-year enrollment average, which means the 340 freshman seats in the class of 2030 will be distributed across the communities with 231 seats for Haverhill. Last month, the school held a lottery drawing for grade 9 fall 2026 admission, and another lottery drawing for grades 10 and 11 is set for May 12th. Newburyport COA Films Senior Citizen Film by Matt Petrie, Newburyport. A documentary is being filmed at the Senior Community Center in an effort to show other communities how local seniors are thriving and not just surviving. The Newburyport Council on Aging has partnered with local Emmy Award-winning producer Lorenzo Minoli to work on the film titled We Were, Are. In a society that prides itself basically to recycle everything, they don't recycle human life. "So I said, this is the moment to do a documentary," he said. COA Program Director Mary Kelly is an associate producer for the film, which aims to answer the question of what it means to live rather than simply exist. "We're basically trying to show other cities how Newburyport lives within their senior community center, and how people, when they retire, it's the start of something beautiful. It's not the end," Kelly said. "We're trying to flip the switch on aging and what it looks like to be an older person." Minoli, 74, said one of the factors that inspired him was experiencing age discrimination when looking for a job after moving to the area. "What was happening was that at a certain point, in one way or another, I was asked how old I was," he said, "and the interview would finish, would not go forward. So I got really, really mad at this thing. You know, there is an attitude toward the seniors that is unhealthy. The idea began to crystallize after meeting Kelly and discovering the COA, Minoli said. This senior center is unbelievable. And there is an energy here that is really a lively energy, he said. So I started to think, maybe we should make something about what this place is about. I felt it was almost like it was a body shop where an older car comes in and then comes out, completely beautifully restored and ready to run again. The idea of the film is to go around and see what seniors in the community are doing with their lives, how they are repurposing their lives, according to Minoli. Some are trying to follow a dream that they had during their life that they are now able to accomplish, he said. Others are offering their knowledge and skills to the community because they're available. So there is treasure to be found that has not been discovered yet. The film is set to debut at the Screening Room in Newburyport on June 20th at noon, with a promo set to be shown at the COA on March 17th. It's something that I'm hoping, personally, that other cities will see around the country and say, this is how this one little city is doing it, Kelly said. And it's really about the history of Newburyport and how the senior citizens of today didn't allow this place to just rot and fall apart. She credited former COA director Roseanne Robillard with setting the stage for the documentary. All of my programming is reflected on what she taught me, Kelly said. To make the film on par with the vision they have, fundraising has begun. We are collaborating with Filmmakers Collaborative. That is our nonprofit that receives the money for us, and we have a presence there, Minoli said. With $25,000 raised toward their goal of $70,000, he conceded that there is still a long way to go. Discussing the effort into going into this, Minoli said it's a passion project. It's a different approach, and I love it, he said. I love this community. I love this place. I love the people that are involved. I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning thinking about how to edit it. It's an ongoing process, and I want this to be a great success, not just for me, but for everybody. To support the film, visit filmmakerscollabinc.networkforgood.com/projects/295381weweare. Salisbury plans for America's 250th. Organizers solicit activity participants by Caitlin D. Salisbury. Planning is underway for the town's version of America's 250th anniversary celebrations, set to sweep the nation this summer. The America's 250th committee met for the second time late last week to plan for a number of events that will begin this spring, honoring the country and the town. The committee meets once a month and is made up of community members as well as members of local organizations such as the Salisbury Lions Club, Salisbury Historical Society, and Salisbury Public Library. So far, a myriad of events spanning the course of multiple months are being planned, from a handmaker's fair this spring celebrating local artisans to a parade during Salisbury Days in September, and more. The intent of the committee is to celebrate Salisbury's contributions to national history, said Jen Rokatenitz, a Salisbury Parks and Recreation administrator who was leading the efforts behind the America's 250th Committee. It is a big deal celebrating 250 years. And so the country has a variety of celebrations, as does the state of Massachusetts, she said. They're really celebrating big throughout the state. Salisbury is so rich in history even from that time period. So we just wanted to make sure that we were celebrating as a community. Similarly, Joyce McKenna, president of the Salisbury Historical Society, said the roots in Salisbury go deep. I think that it shouldn't be lost on people that we're one of the earliest settlements, she said. And the names of the people who would have been living here during the Revolution and prior to, you still have a lot of those same families here. The committee is not solely focusing on July 4th for the celebrations and intends to spread events out, Rokitenitz said. What is great and unique about our town is that because we are Oceanside, sometimes it can be tricky to plan summertime events, she said, because logistically you're contending with traffic and all the things that are happening, competing with things that are happening up at the beach. So we are embracing that, and the beach will be hosting a number of events for the week of the July 4th. And then we'll be peppering events before the summer starts and after the summer ends around town. The committee is even looking for more perspectives and encourages those interested to join in on the planning efforts, Rokitenitz said. The committee is open to anybody, any resident, or anybody that takes an interest in wanting to be a part of the 250th celebrations. As I See It, Changing My Point of View by Stuart Dean. As I See It has suddenly been turned on its head, so to speak. While I once needed corrective lenses for distance vision and could see without correction on close work, I now see clearly in the distance but need glasses for reading. What goes on here? I just had cataract surgery. As a small boy in the third grade, I had been prescribed glasses for, among other reasons, to be able to see the school blackboard or a pitched baseball. I'll never forget my first fight on the way to school when a close friend called me, Mr. Peepers, after the Wally Cox character in the 1950s TV show of that name. I also have a clipping from my old hometown newspaper, the Athol Daily News, reporting on the results of a local Little League baseball game. Yes, that was done in those days. In it, I am described as a bespectacled first sacker. I wore those glasses until the summer before my freshman year in high school, when I became one of the pioneers in the use of contact lenses. Those lenses, as I've noted in the past, plus a 6-inch growth spurt and a new spike-up hairstyle, gave me a new image. At the same time, the images I saw became much clearer. I remember for the first time seeing trees as a collection of individual leaves, as opposed to a green blob. The first contacts were large, rigid plastic discs that required some break-in time. Until I got used to them, I blinked a lot and shied away from bright lights. Even when I got used to them, complications were inherent. As a first baseman on the high school baseball team, I once collided with the catcher on a pop-up down the first baseline, dislodging and losing a lens, which necessitated that I be removed from the game. That happened on a number of occasions in my basketball career as well, including when the time when the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force service teams in France were photographed crawling around the floor looking for my lost lens. But the ability to see clearly more than made up for the inconvenience. Over time, contact lens development led to smaller lenses and more comfortable material, right up to the current floppy disposable lenses. As I aged, however, I found it more difficult to insert and take out these new lenses and reverted most of the time to the use of traditional glasses, saving the contacts for such sporting events as skiing or golf or other social events as a family reunion or a formal civic function. But in recent annual examinations, my eye doctor began to note the development of cataracts to the point that I finally qualified for surgery. Along the way, I began to have some difficulty in driving at night, avoiding that whenever possible. It was time. But then I had a choice to make: correction for perfect distance vision, correction for perfect close vision, correction of one eye done for each distance with the brain eventually making the adjustment, or finally a bifocal lens in each eye. While insurance covers only the first three, that wasn't the deciding factor for me. I just wanted to have, for the first time in my life, perfect unassisted distance vision for driving, for watching TV, for playing golf, for attending social occasions. I didn't mind at all the idea of slipping on a pair of reading glasses for the morning newspaper or the computer screen. I was simply flip-flopping the times I would need to use glasses. To say the least, I was a bit nervous for the early morning appointment to replace the first lens. After all, they were cutting into my eye. But everyone was pleasant. After being prepped with an electronic monitoring device and anesthesia tubing, I was ushered into the operating room and positioned on the table. And then, don't remember what happened. The next thing I do remember is drinking orange juice and eating sugar cookies. Thank you, anesthesia. In the interim, I had a new eye, though it would be days before the vision cleared entirely. 3 weeks later, the picture came into further focus as the second eye was done, though that too had to settle down after the surgical procedure when a small capillary broke sometime in the night and left me with a bright red corner of my eye the next morning. A quick return to the doctor's office assured me that it would fade away, and it eventually did. So after some 75 years, I can see clearly now. Thank you, Johnny Nash. Please let me know if my viewpoint changes in these As I See It columns. After all, I'm looking at things a little differently now. Stuart Dean lives in Newburyport. Amesbury Carriage Museum examines presidential transportation by Caitlin D. Amesbury. Local kids got to learn about presidential transportation in an interactive, fun way on Monday, thanks to the Amesbury Carriage Museum. In honor of President's Day, the museum held the Carriage to Cadillac presidential transport event on Monday afternoon. During the event, people got to craft their own carriages out of cardboard, bottle caps, and balloons, learn about the transportation used by U.S. presidents, and more. Kaylee Renard Cryan, education coordinator at the museum, said her goal was for kids to be able to visit the museum on the holiday and learn about history in a hands-on way. I want to be able to invite kids in the space during the February vacation and on President's Day, she said. So Renard Cryan said she began research carriages associated to Amesbury as well as former U.S. presidents. As a result of her research, she found that one of the carriages on display at the museum is similar to the transportation used by the former President Franklin Pierce. She also learned that former President Howard Taft had steam engine cars, which connects to the steam engine on display in the museum. I was so great to be able to do this research and find connections, and being able to connect Amesbury kids to U.S. presidents, Renard Cryan said. Such events where national figures and history can be tied to Amesbury are helpful for getting kids interested in local history. I've been talking with a whole bunch of local teachers, and they want to teach their kids local history, she said, and they want to connect it to that broader context. Why Amesbury? Why is Amesbury important? Why should we be proud to be in this town? And so that's what I've been trying to do with programs. The event was beneficial to the parents as well as children, offering parents the chance to get with their kids out and learning during the school break, Riddard Cryan said. I have a coworker. She has kiddos, and she's always wondering what she's going to do with the kiddos during February vacation, Riddard Cryan said. Because kids always want to do things, and because they love learning through play, which is what I love to be able to provide. And so I wanted to have things available, and so many places are closed during President's Day that where are they going to go? What are they going to do? Just sit at home? And so I wanted to provide an outlet for our community, she said. Kelly Ferguson, a mom who brought about her children to the event, praised the Carriage Museum and said in a month where there's not much to be do outdoors, events like these are great opportunities. I come here a lot because it's a really great place to come, and they always do something new and interesting, she said. Now the museum is looking ahead to the next school vacation in April, when Riddard Cryan said the museum will be celebrating its grand reopening. Elks Club hosts dinner, Newburyport. The Newburyport Elks Club will host a free dinner for seniors on Sunday from noon to 2:30 p.m. The menu features turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, squash, green beans, gravy, rolls, and pies. For more information, call the lodge at 978-465-9872. North Atlantic right whale found dead, Boston. New England Aquarium recently identified a North Atlantic right whale found dead off Virginia as a three-year-old female, the second detected right whale death in just 2 weeks. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration received a report on Tuesday of a whale carcass on a barrier island off the eastern shore of Virginia. Scientists from the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at New England Aquarium identified the whale. She is the second right whale to die in the last 2 weeks after the carcass of a four-year-old male, Division, was found dead off of North Carolina on January 27th, following a serious fishing gear entanglement. To say that this death is disheartening, particularly so soon after the death of Division 2 weeks ago, would be an understatement. This young female was seen in October with no sign of injury or compromised health. We are hopeful that an examination of the carcass will provide insights into her cause of death, said Heather Pettis, senior scientist at the aquarium's Anderson Cabot Center. NOAA's fisheries said it is working with Marine Mammal Stranding Network partners to examine, document, and necropsy the whale carcass. A cause of death has not yet been released. The deceased whale had a rich family history tracked through the North Atlantic Right Whale Catalog, curated by the New England Aquarium. Her mom, 25-year-old Portia, has given birth to three whales, all of which have now died, the previous two from fishing entanglements. Her grandmother, Mantis, is over 40 years old and has birthed eight calves, most of recent of which was spotted in December. The family tree also includes an aunt, Squilla, another right whale that was sighted with a new calf this season. The loss of a young female is especially impactful for an already small population. Given the opportunity, a single female could add at least 10 whales to the right whale population in her lifetime, said Amy Warren, scientific program officer at the Anderson Cabot Center. North Atlantic right whales are one of the most endangered large whale species in the world, with an estimated population of about 380 and only 72 reproductive females. Entanglements and vessel strikes remain the leading cause of death and injury for the species. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.